Right now, my next guest is running for New York City Council, and he's in Chicago tonight for a fundraiser. Why Chicago? Well, when you served under President Obama, you get support from his hometown. Ronnie Cho was the Millennial Outreach Director for the Obama administration. He's making the move and running for office. He's running for the District 2 seat that represents parts of the Lower East Side in Manhattan. And his old pals, which include David Axelrod and former Secretary of Education Arne Duncan, hosted a fundraiser tonight. Cho not only served the president for both millennial outreach and public engagement, but he just resigned as VP of Public Affairs for MTV. Not bad for a man who just turned 34 years old. Ronnie Cho is trying to become the first Korean-American to ever hold a seat on the New York City Council. And he's part of a new movement in the Democratic Party of young Obama staffers stepping out on their own. Ronnie Cho, my guest tonight on The Download. Ronnie, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Justin, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So let's talk about this. I mean, I read that that you're really inspired to run for office. It wasn't necessarily your path, but you listened to the words of your former boss.
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, I was just here just a few months ago, and I always love being back in Chicago. It feels so familiar, so many amazing friends and family that are from Chicago. And I was in that amazing audience with, you know, thousands of other people who are listening to President Obama's final speech. And there's one line in particular, and to paraphrase it, he said, if you're disappointed with your elected officials, grab a clipboard, get some signatures, and run for office yourself. And I was there with my mother, my immigrant mother who came here from South Korea with nothing at all, and her and my mom. And my mom and dad came here from South Korea. And to just be there with her, we're crying, we're having this emotional moment. And it's when I thought up in my mind that I'm going to run for office. And that's when I decided to run. But I think why I'm running is a different question. Mm-hmm. And that is drawn from, you know, sort of what I just spoke about, being a son of immigrants who came here from South Korea, who had nothing. We lived in a car the first, you know, on and off first couple of years of my life, looking for odd jobs, mostly on the West Coast. I grew up in Arizona. You know, there were janitors and bookkeepers and just cobbling together a life just to make it happen for the family. And, you know, within one lifetime of having that experience and having a good education, a neighborhood that actually cared and rallied around you and supported you, even though we didn't look like anyone in my neighborhood in Phoenix, that there was a shared sense of values, and that within that lifetime you can work at the elbow of the President of the United States. Like, what a country and what opportunities there are in this place that we all call home, that I want to bring those same kind of opportunities to the kids in my neighborhood.
Well, I mean, it's amazing too, because, you know, to have you and to have a presidential aide of any kind in studio is always fun. But to be a millennial outreach director, to be a youth advocate for a president that really did for the first time in American history connect with a generation, a younger generation. I mean, you could say what you will about President Clinton and the sort of movement of MTV, but the movement, the issues, even down to the way he governed, he really thought about a very a different generation, a millennial generation. And that had a lot to do with you and your office and what you guys have tried to accomplish. Talk about that. Talk about the idea of politics for younger people, for people who might not, are just turning 18, 19, 20 years old, who might be voting for the first time.
You know, you're absolutely right. He was able to inspire an optimism that I think, you know, I'll push back a little bit on it being a new thing in a way that it was unprecedented. I think it's maybe the most elemental thing about American politics is that America is about optimism. It's about hope. It's about what's possible, even though it's not in front of us. It may seem unlikely, but we hold out hope of what could be if we really work hard. And he was able to tap into, I think, the most authentically American value we all have of hope. And with that, I think that's inherent in youth and young people, of like not being sort of shackled of old days and old ways of doing things. It's just about the now and it's about tomorrow. And for him to project a vision for the country and to be the person at the White House who was the conduit between this generation, millennials, and a president who shares a special connection to, man, I can't imagine a better job at the White House. It's the only one I ever wanted to have.
And you know, to be fair, I mean, you see the president slow jamming the news, mic drops, using different platforms, social media platforms, and no president would ever go near. You know, speaking in native language, if you will. I mean, that's what I'm talking about. This idea that it wasn't just about youth. You know, the young people have a chance. Let's give them hope. I mean, you were talking about issues like student loan relief, you know, and other things that were important to a generation, not just giving it lip service, but actually trying to change things.
That's absolutely right. I think, you know, what I always find funny is when, whether it's pundits or researchers or what have you, they talk about millennials like there's some alien species. Like, what do millennials want? What do they think? What do they like to eat? And then, you know, what do they care about? And, you know, there was not an ounce of, being patronizing to young people. It's like, I want to know what young people care about because they care about what we all care about. We want a good job. We want a good education. We want safe streets, clean air, clean water, an opportunity to thrive and pursue our dreams. And that's no different than any other generation. And so for him to come, you know, from a perspective of actually authentically connecting in that way and not just pandering or pretending to speak in this language and slang and sort of this, you know, casual language was not authentic. That was not who he was, and it's not who he is. And I think that's why, you know, you can't fake that kind of authenticity. And that's why I think he will always have a connection to not only people who voted for him who are now in their 20s and 30s, but people who are in their teens who are watching him and you know, learning more about his presidency.
You know, it's interesting too because you we're talking with Ronnie Cho. He's a former millennial outreach director for the Obama administration. He's running for New York City Council District 2. He's in Chicago tonight for a fundraiser with his former presidential pals. Mm-hmm. It's a great for me. It's very delicious to be like he's running for New York City Council, so he comes to Chicago. Like right. there's something to that. But you know. It is interesting because there are several, and I've been reading today about a lot of Obama staffers and a younger generation of politicians, if you will, stepping out, running for office, running for Congress, running for local races, not unlike yours, New York City Council. Talk about that. Talk about the idea of this movement, the push to sort of take back the Democratic Party, you know, and from a younger perspective.
Yeah, you know, I think what the party needs, and even more importantly, the country needs, is a new generation of leadership. That this generation, millennials, who are the largest generation the country's ever seen, the most diverse, the most educated, the most tolerant generation, to really step into the role of governing. And we are underrepresented in virtually every level of power, from business to academia to certainly politics. And that doesn't always have to be, and power is not going to give itself up without a fight. So it's important that we understand our place in history, our importance in both economically, socially, politically, what have you, in American life, to assert ourselves and say we're here and we're ready to serve and deliver for the American people. And I think young people right now, you know, there are a few other staffers in 2017. You know, in fairness, there's not that many opportunities to run in this off-year election, and hopefully my candidacy and others can be inspired by what we're doing and the message of running on, you know, doing something new and fresh and like trying to imagine bigger and imagine better possibilities and better outcomes that folks in 2018, 2020, and so on and so forth can finally step up and say the Democratic Party needs to be represented by more than old white people.
Yeah. Well, you know, Thomas Frank, the historian that was in here not too long ago, and he wrote a book called Listen, Liberal, Whatever Happened to the Power or the Party of the People. Mm-hmm. He talked about how the Democratic Party really made a switch, and now it's much more about representing the creative class, the middle class, and working people and people in poverty have been left behind. Do you agree with that sentiment when you're running on the Democratic platform in the state of, or in the city of New York? Do you agree with that? And if not, I mean, how do you change it? How do you bring back the sort of values that the Democrats have run on in the last 20, 30 years?
You know, I think there's no doubt that we as a party did not deliver on what has been a fundamental tenet of our platform is to fight for working people. We did not do that effectively in 2016. I think, you know, we got sort of distracted by a cultural and sort of creative class that, you know, thankfully we were happy to have their support. But at the end of the day, does that really resonate with, you know, the working white class person who is just struggling to make ends meet, or, you know, folks in suburbia that are still getting squeezed because they're making too much in order to benefit from some social programs, mm-hmm. but not quite enough to really be considered
right.
Impoverished. And there's a group of people that, you know, I see that in my district all the time of folks who are just trying to make it work, but are feeling like there's a disconnect between them and their government. And that's why I'm running for city council. I feel like it's the most exciting place in American politics to be on the grassroots level. If you care and if you believe as I do, the government can and should be a force of good in people's lives, that if you really care about that, you'd want that proximity between government and constituency to be as small as possible.
I can't think of a better representation of what we're talking about in this country than, say, the Lower East Side of Manhattan. When you talk about inequality, mm-hmm. the concept that that area from the Bowery to Lower East Side with some of the tenements, the idea that all the immigrants that came and set up shop in New York City to make a life and with nothing in their pockets to start their life in America, versus what's happening now in New York City, where if you live in Manhattan, you're paying millions of dollars to live in a condo, you know, like a small space. Mm-hmm. But there really is. I mean, you could have on one block an impoverished family and on the other a tech billionaire. I mean, the Lower East Side is like that in the way that there's a lot of different things happening. So it is almost a microcosm of what's happening in the country. How can you as a local city councilman govern in that way? How do you sort of represent both of those type of people?
Well, you know, I think it's tough. You know, there's no easy answer to that. I think, and it's also, I think, a false choice to decide if you're going to be for development or anti-development or for preservation or anti-preservation. I think there is a very important and a yawning gap that's in the middle of folks who understand that New York City, in my neighborhood in particular, East Village, Gramercy Park, Union Square, historic neighborhoods,
yeah,
and
right.
iconic neighborhoods in New York, that we want to preserve the character and all the history. But also New York City it's New York City. It's going to attract people from all over the country and all over the world, the best and the brightest talent to come here to make a life, to make a dream come true and chase something big. We need to accommodate that. That's what has made New York City, respectfully Chicago, the greatest city in the world. And
debatable, but go ahead.
Similar to, you know, what happens in Chicago. People come here because it's an amazing place, and we need to make room for that because, again, places like New York City, places like my district are about the future. It's always been about the future and refreshing itself and reinventing itself, whether you're in the tenement houses in Lower East Side that was mostly populated by garment workers, Jewish immigrants, Russian immigrants, Chinese, like a true American melting pot that can reinvent itself generation after generation. And I think it's our time as millennials to define what this city really means. Is it an Epcot center for the 1%, or is it still going to be the place that Lady Liberty holds up and says, all are welcome, come here and make a life and chase a dream?
My last question for you tonight, and it's interesting because you have, and you've commented on a lot of things, national politics, things that are happening in Washington with the Trump administration. You obviously had, you're at the elbow of the president of the United States and all the achievements and outreach that you did in the White House. But all politics is local. Mm-hmm. And what I know of the aldermen in the city of Chicago is if there's a pothole on Ashland, they got to fix it. Are you prepared to be a city councilman who may want to say something about making sure that there's equal rights for mm-hmm. LGBTQ, mm-hmm. but at the same time, there's a water main break, you know, on Houston? Like, what? I mean, are you prepared for that dichotomy, that contrast in politics?
Well, Justin, not only am I prepared for it, I am attracted and drawn to that challenge where, you know, we're living in extraordinary circumstances. I believe we live in the most extraordinary period in human history where you have to walk and chew gum at the same time. You need to make sure that whether it's on 14th Street or Ashland or it's Broadway or Michigan Avenue, you've got to pay attention to what matters to people who live there, who work there, who commute there, as well as you need to keep an eye on what the hell Trump says and national politics. And you have to pay attention to both of them because the world's getting smaller and smaller every day. And even though it's talking about, you know, potholes or there's a street lights out, also, what's your opinion on trade? What's your opinion Russia? You need to have an opinion about that because not only as elected officials do you need to know that, but the electorate is so much more educated now and there's so much more information and also misinformation. So I think we have a responsibility to be fluent in all of those things.
Ronnie Cho, the former Millennial Outreach Director for the Obama administration in the White House, is running for New York City Council District 2. He's in town tonight. His old pals, including David Axelrod and former Secretary of Education Artie Duncan, through a fundraiser. Thanks for coming in studio. I appreciate it. Good luck with your election, and come back to Chicago.
Justin, it's always Chicago always feels like home to me. Thank you so much, and I look forward to seeing you guys again soon.